ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
Devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. I'm your host, Kristen Lopez.
And I'm Drea Clark.
And we're back. I know 2019 has essentially been started for the last, 3 weeks, but I had to move. So moving is very hard.
Moving counts.
We're finally getting to our episode for this month, and I'm excited to be back. Are you excited for another year of ticklish business, Drea?
I am, especially since I finally figured my way over to Canopy. My door has been opened again in terms of new access to films. New access to old films, is that?
It's been great. As I was telling Drea, I moved to Southern California, so we are actually in the same zip code, I think.
We are.
We're closer than we were before. I've been going to the libraries and the classic film section in the libraries has been amazing, but then I also have my classic flicks, which I get mailed to me, and it's just been me watching a lot of John Garfield, which I'm not.
Oh, I was gonna say your weak spot, but I know you have several.
I have several, but if I could go back in time, save John Garfield from communists, that's a movie. That's a pick right there. Someone give me $1 million to make a movie where a young girl saves John Garfield from communism with time machines. If they let Colin Trevorrow do it, then they should let me do it.
Yes. We can also not guarantee your safety. to pun on his movie title, his first movie.
Exactly.
It's a good pitch.
So what is your holidays and New Year been like, Drea? It's been a while since we've all talked.
It has. Mine are good. I'm originally from the Midwest, but my parents retired to Northern California. So I headed up there for Christmas. I had a very brief Christmas and a short New Year's. I work the Golden Globes. I work on the nominee packages, and the nominees are. Although they never show the bulk of what we make because it's a live show. So we edit a longer and a shorter package for every category. And of course, they'd rather show the famous people drunken talking in the ballroom than the stuff we've been slaving over for a month. So it means I work over a lot of the holidays. But it's nice since my parents are relatively close, so I can still get up and see the family for a little bit. Were you in town?
We celebrated Christmas back in Sacramento, and then literally the next day, the 26th, we started packing.
Oh, that's right. moved right over. Yes,
right,
that's
right. Yeah, we had been packing the week before, but literally my mom threw the Christmas tree outside. And we started stuffing things into boxes, and then we moved down here the 27th. So I celebrated New Year's down here by myself because I was thinking, okay, I hadn't acclimated to the city yet, and my friends had plans, so I just sat and watched movies, and it was actually really pleasant. I'm officially all set up down here. I've been down to the Linwood Dunn Theater. I got to see discussion about women in the silent film industry and how the belief that there were no women making movies in the silent film days is BS, and it was really interesting. And I was so happy that I got to actually discuss classic cinema with people that understand it. And I met Diane Warren there.
What?
Academy Award nominee Diane Warren. Yes, she likes classic cinema. And she was at that event just chilling and listening to the organist. And it was awesome.
That blows my mind.
I was telling her that I was a classic film person. And she was talking about Stella Dallas. And she said, Stella Dallas with that woman. I'm like, Barbara Stanwyck. And this is a direct quote. And she's like, wow. You really know your shit, don't you? And I was whoa, not to chew my horn.
So now you can change your bio to Diane Warren says I know my shit?
Yes, I can essentially say that Diane Warren and I are best friends now.
Of course,
obviously.
Yeah.
We're Facebook friends. She friended me on Facebook right then and there.
Oh, wow. That's
so
cool.
I feel we're buddies.
It's good. Gonna say, I do think it's funny, we're here, we've started the creep into 2019, but I'm excited that what you and I are talking about are the last remnants of good things that we found in 2018.
Yeah, I don't know if you know this, but 2018 kind of sucked.
Yes.
There was a lot of bad. But in the world of classic cinema, we found some light at the end of the tunnel. And so we're talking about our best discoveries of 2018. These are classic films. And I say classic as in classic era. I've had to rewrite this headline for my site several years. Because if you put best new to me films, they say, well, that sounds like a mouthful. If you put best classic films, you get someone who inevitably says, well, these aren't classics.
Right.
No, so if you say best classic era films, we're going to go with new discoveries. That's pretty vague. So these could be movies that we had just never seen before. That pre-1970, I think, was the cutoff. But, of course, we play fast and loose with the time period here. I had 16 to choose from this year.
Yikes. That's nice.
You can find the list of 16 with my proper explanations at my website, journeysinclassicfilm.com, where I laid everything out. So it was very hard to choose between 3 and 5. And I think because it's just you and I, we could probably do 5. What was your overall takeaway from the movies that you were deciding on this year to include on this list?
I don't track what movies I watch.
I'm a nerd. I got a Letterboxd account and I keep track of everything.
I figured you had a pretty color-coded situation. I don't write them down. Part of it is because my job as a film programmer means I watch hundreds and hundreds of indies that no one will see. Or that, like, so if I wrote them all down, I think it would bum me out of, like, how much time are you spending on screens? Because I also do it for enjoyment. So, and differentiating between them would be hard. And I just was never in that habit. So in coming up with this list, it was a more a matter of going back. And, you know, we had also talked about really having this highlight in a way why something like Filmstruck or just curated programs, if be it streaming services or if you have great theatrical outlets near you that do pay attention to these and the people who put their like passion and brains into finding films and bring them to people. So for me, it was also what was I able to access this year through Filmstruck that was new to me, that impressed me in a really specific way and also influenced how I see other films and really stood out. So I was more looking of like, what do I remember talking about a lot? And all of the ones that I picked actually have interesting dovetails into contemporary Hollywood films or international films too, even of just how they influenced artists, of how their stories are still used, the thought conversations. It was a nice reflection moment for me to come up with these.
See, I went a completely different direction. If you look at 16, a lot of my decisions were based on actors. And that could be that, much like Drea, I watch a lot of movies, particularly contemporary films, for my job as a critic. And so classics are usually more fun pastime for me than anything else. And this year, I really cut back on writing about classic films. A lot of the movies that I did end up picking were stuff that I remembered significantly in December. It's very hard to remember anything you've watched in January if you watch as many movies as Drea and I do. And so a movie that can really stick out is important. It also helps that a lot of my favorite actors this year really took the forefront. And you could say that probably was because I limited a lot of my viewing to trying to watch as much of their filmography as I can. But you're going to see a lot of the same people pop up on this list, so you can't fault me for it. Because so we're gonna do top 5. Drea, why don't you start us off with your number 5?
Okay, so my number 5 was a film that definitely is a thinker. It's from 1966 and it's Persona by Ingmar Bergman. I had seen The Seventh Seal back in college and obviously had studied Bergman and his influence, but I had never seen Persona. And so when it popped up and I read the description and was like, okay, two female leads, I can get behind that. You know, even a lot of modern films, but certainly a lot of classics, women tend to be more of a supporting figure or the villain, the femme fatale. This, I was like, oh, a two-hander with women in 1966. It's a psychological drama about a nurse and her patient. And the patient is this actress who's gone mute. suddenly. She can no longer speak. They've sort of determined that for the actress's recovery, these two should go to an isolated cottage. And while they're there, and the actress still is mute and very internalized, the nurse starts to confess all of these increasingly intimate secrets to her. It eventually evolves to that interesting psychological where you're wondering, like, oh, are both of them real? Is one of them a figment? Is there something larger at play? Is there a supernatural element? And it's fascinating that way. And it has this incredible inventive technological work. So they do all of these overlapping shots because the women intentionally resemble each other, and they start to, how he frames them and lights them, and then they'll do cut to cut. So you're really questioning just their dual natures and dual figures. And there's also all these practical effects like smoke sort of worked in. So it was such an incredible find. And then I happened to be lucky enough to be going to dinner with someone who had seen it. It's a joy in any era, especially something that's been around for so long. So hopefully so many people will see it, get the option to see it. There is so much to dig into. There's psychology, there's filmmaking, there's the idea that the analysis of this film could go on forever. And it also has made me really view some contemporary directors, particularly Olivier Assayas. I'm not sure if I'm saying his name right.
I believe you are.
Okay. Phew. He has some recent films like The Clouds of Cecile Marie and Personal Shopper. And actually even Lynch's Mulholland Drive. I was like, oh, this film, it would not surprise me to find out that a lot of modern auteurs saw this film, saw how far it went, and were like, this, I want to be doing this with my filmmaking. Persona. It was a total standout.
Can I say that Mulholland Drive, if we included contemporary films, would have been on my first time viewing list for 2018. I had never seen
really?
It until last year. Yeah.
Nice. All yep. right.
So yeah, cross that off the list. My number five is, you brought up Filmstruck, which we lost last year.
R.I.P.
It still really upsets me. But I did try to get as many movies as I could under my belt from that service before it closed. I tried to watch as many movies that did not have DVD releases, because I don't know if you know this, but a lot of the films on Filmstruck had not been released on DVD or Blu-ray. And one of them, I'm actually very surprised that it's not released on DVD or Blu-ray, was 1949's The Passionate Friends. This is a movie that, speaking of modern day comparisons, I believe Paul Thomas Anderson said that this is what inspired him to do Phantom Thread. And he recommended that people watch this because it was a direct influence on that film. Hopefully when the Criterion streaming service starts up again, they will have this and you can watch it, because it is unfortunately not available. It's a really great movie. I'm woefully underseen on Lean's films, because I thought a lot of them were like Lawrence of Arabia and they were 4 hours long, and I'm sorry, I just don't have time for that. This is actually a lot like one of his other movies that I know Drea is probably going to bring up, so I'm not going to spoil it. But it's the story of a young woman named Mary, played by Anne Todd, who is married to this guy named Howard, played by Claude Rains, but she's still hung up on this former boyfriend of hers, played by Trevor Howard. Through a series of events, her and Trevor Howard end up on this remote vacation destination, actually in adjoining hotel rooms, because movies. They start spending time together, but Claude Rains shows up knowing their history and assumes that something untoward has happened. And it's not a tawdry melodrama. It's a really authentic examination about love and regret, and how we do love people, but we are always going to regret the ones that got away. And I really love the camera work. It's not surprising that Lean's camera work is fantastic, but here it's amazing to see what he does with a romantic drama like this. There's a scene involving a business card where the camera just cuts between the business card and Claude Rains' face. And it tells you everything that you need to know about what he's thinking, what that card means, what he thinks about his wife, what he thinks about Trevor Howard. And it's just a two shot of a business card and a reaction. And I think that's utterly amazing that this is a movie that does not spell out for the audience. It doesn't need to what you're supposed to infer about this relationship. And it ends in a way that feels authentic. Even if the characters end up together, you feel like that's the right choice for them. It's a beautiful, really interesting movie about relationships that we just don't make anymore. And I wish that they would put it out on DVD, because I think a lot of people would really enjoy it, especially if it's influencing Paul Thomas Anderson's.
I am going to go directly into my one that's related. Before we started taping, I had mentioned to you that I had a David Lean film, and then we both had this kind of, oh, like nervous pause of, did we choose the same movie?
I had to ask her, which one are you doing? We wanted to spread the love as best we could. So I was like, God, please don't let it be this.
I know. It is interesting that out of all of the things, if we are choosing five discoveries, that even landing on the same director is kind of exciting. Although it's David Lean, so it's not like you don't have a lot to choose from. And the one that had been a new discovery for me of his is Brief Encounter from 1945. Like you just said, there is a really interesting similarity between Brief Encounter and The Passionate Friends in terms of infidelity and relationships. Because David Lean, when I think of him as such an epic director of doing these really huge cinematic, the Lawrence of Arabia and Dr. Zhivago and these sweeping scale films. And so, and I haven't seen Passionate Friends, but Brief Encounter is so stripped down from that, but still has his eye and his way of using storytelling. And it's like you said, with that business card moment, there's something about standout directors. When you try and explain to people the art of filmmaking and why some people bring or elevate their stories, David Lean is a great example of someone who used so many tools in his toolbox to really build something. And Brief Encounter is also a Noel Coward adaptation. I know he did a few films adapted from Coward's work, but I always think of Noel Coward as being such a comic writer. And this story is really complicated and emotional, much more than it is comedic. Again, it's about a housewife who's married with children and leads a very conventional life. And she happens to meet, she goes in every week for like shopping and go to a matinee. And she happens to meet another married man who is in town on a similar schedule. The relationship that develops between them is all the richer for the fact that they deny themselves a physical connection. So it progresses further than it would if it was just a sexual affair. But the kind of meeting of the minds and making you wonder if your life is where it needs to be. And again, in the takeaway of these kinds of films, in looking at especially Noel Coward, of this being possibly an allegory to his own closeted sexuality and what relationships he might have been denied because of circumstance. So there's a lot to dig into. Because I said, like, this was new to me, Celia Johnson plays the lead female, and of course Trevor Howard, whom I love from The Third Man. But Celia Johnson, when I saw her, I just was immediately thinking of the headmistress of Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, which is such a different character than this one. And there's always something so nice, especially if you've seen an actor and you've liked a performance of theirs, and to see them in something else doing something totally different where you get an idea of their range. It's so fun. It's so nice to see talented people. And it's that kind of, oh, wow, they're really working with something. So Brief Encounter was a really nice discovery for me.
It's been a while since I've seen that one. I need to revisit it. I watched it a long time ago when I was just dabbling in classic cinema, so I need to give it a revisit.
Just a baby film nerd.
Exactly. When I was just young and naive and knew nothing about the world. My number four is, you're going to hear a lot of this name on this list, Ida Lupino. Oh, you guys thought I was going to say somebody else's name. I know.
I know exactly what name you thought I was going to think you said. How's that for a circular?
Ida's my girl, and I watched as many movies as I could of hers this last year because she's fantastic and she deserves all the praise. And it was really hard for me to decide which of the movies that I wanted of hers that I wanted to include, but I wanted to go with one also that is not available on DVD, which is very upsetting to me because it's fantastic. It's from 1941. It's called Ladies in Retirement. I am a big fan of movies about women supporting women. And I think that in these times, we often don't see that as something that doesn't come with a fair bit of cattiness a la The Women. This is not that. This is harkening back to Ida Lupino's English roots. If you didn't know, she was actually a British national. It follows a domestic servant played by Ida Lupino, who is struggling to keep her employer happy. She's employed to this daffy woman, and she's told that her two sisters, one of whom is played by Elsa Lanchester, have been kicked out of the institution that they've been staying in, and they have nowhere to go. They're going to have to stay with their sister, who is Ida Lupino. Her sisters, unfortunately, are mentally disturbed. All of the decisions that her character Ellen makes throughout the movie's subsequent runtime are because her sisters have been shunted off from institution to institution. They just want to stay together as a family. And she knows that if they get sent away again, they're going to be separated. A lot of her decision-making comes from this mad desire to keep her family together. And that eventually leads to murder and blackmail and all these other things. But it's got a really, really dark heart about how women often have to make these really horrific decisions in order to keep their families together. And I think it's fascinating coming out in the midst of World War II, where a lot of single women were struggling to keep their children fed, were struggling to keep a roof over their families' heads. And this is about a woman trying to, yes, keep two grown women who are childlike safe, but it's still that concept of most women are an inch away from having to murder somebody if it means keeping their family unit together. It's a really melancholy film that doesn't have a lot of easy answers. Everybody's fantastic, and Ida Lupino is great. Elsa Lanchester's really good. I'm really not understanding why this movie has never been released on DVD, because it's brilliant.
You've sold me.
I can tell you that there is a place you can watch it. It starts with a U and ends in a 2. So if you look for it online, you can find it. And it's unfortunate that you have to stream it off of YouTube in order to watch it, but it's worth it.
I would definitely check that out. And I think you're so right in terms of what we're looking for in supporting female artists and how that can be difficult in classic, but also that in, and again, I'm using our sort of open-ended, ticklish version of classic, there is a lot more there. The presumption that there weren't women making marks, or that the women who did, like your best friend Ida Lupino, who had like a whole range of things. It's not like she made one movie and disappeared forever. There's so much to explore there.
Right. And what I really appreciated is that this is a movie about a grown woman, single woman, and it's not about finding a man. It's about trying to care for her two sisters who are also grown women, and because of society's treatment of them. I watched it, and watching how other characters respond to these two women who are obviously mentally challenged, hearing their response, like, the movie really wants you to believe that, no, these people are wrong. You should be sympathizing. Yes, these two women make mistakes, but they literally don't know any better. And how horrible is it that these people just think, oh, just send them away? I was like, wow, for 1941, it's really progressive about, like, mental impairments.
I haven't seen this, and I wouldn't think that that would be something that was being explored in any detail. So, good choice.
Well, Drea, what's your next one?
Okay, well, my next one is earlier. It is from an earlier film, and I actually watched this because with the Bradley Cooper A Star Is Born version out and, you know, up for Oscars now and being this big thing, and everybody's been revisiting the previous A Star Is Born iterations, I found my way finally to What Price Hollywood last year.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah, and so it's from 1932, directed by George Cukor. Cukor? Cukor?
Common pronunciation is Cukor.
Cukor, man, I was not even close. He never corrects me. Lets me say it however I want. Yeah, so George Cukor, as the kids say, and our buddy David O. Selznick produced it. In watching it, because I am very familiar with The Star is Born, I was like, those movies pretty egregiously lifted this plot. Constance Bennett plays an aspiring actress. She's a waitress. She's just a sort of blue-collar girl. And then she meets this very drunk and charming film director. They kind of have an evening hanging out together, hanging out in quotation marks. She finds her way doing a screen test and works her way up. So it's the same element of her star is rising and eventually her career as an actress grows and grows while this director's career wanes. It's that same kind of finding, you know, the stardom. What is it like of a shooting star? There's probably like a parabola kind of arc to it, and they are crossing in the night. The main differentiation I found in the story was that rather than having him also fulfill the love interest that conflicts with her, they bring in a second character. So there's a second man that she falls for and is romantically involved with and marries and has a kid with. And he is very put out by her success. But then the same tragic end for the fallen star male, if that makes sense. So the thread of A Star is Born is all right there. And apparently RKO had considered filing a plagiarism suit against Selznick for future adaptations because of the similarities, but let it go. It was a whole thing, which makes sense. But it was really interesting going back and being like, oh yeah, this is actually what the fourth version of that story? The first one, but...
The first one, yeah, and technically, I think, yeah, the
fourth.
The
right, fourth. Yeah, because it's before the Frederick March. But so it was really interesting going back, and Constance Bennett is just really beguiling. Like, I found her so easy to watch. Such a strong, unique character. I mean, the recognizable blonde, but I don't know. There was just something to her I really liked. And it was this thing of, oh, this is truly Hollywood's A Tale as Old as Time. Men decrepit and drunk and falling apart, and women treasured for their youth and talent for a certain amount of time anyway. Yeah, it was nice seeing this sort of genesis of that recurring story.
Yeah, that one's really good. It's, again, another one that I haven't seen in a long time, and I need to revisit it. I finally saw the 37 Frederick March version of A Star is Born for the first time last year. That was the only one I hadn't seen. I still maintain the 54 version is the best of all of them.
Well, because Cukor had already worked out the kinks with this one.
Exactly, exactly, yeah. So... Sorry if you think that the 76 one or the Bradley Cooper version is the best.
Nobody thinks the 76 version is the best. I promise. No one thinks that.
I revisited that last year. I shotgunned literally all four, the actual Star is Borns, back to back to back.
Whoa.
To back. What Price Hollywood's the first, but I think it might be the fifth. I forget the 76 one exists.
There's one of five. How's that?
But I did watch the 76 version this year, and I was thinking, God, this movie's horrendous. Sorry, Barbara.
Bless her heart.
So my number three is, again, another movie from 1941 that is also not available on DVD, but you can find it on the Tube of You. Who would have thunk YouTube
I know.
Be the place to find classic film? It's a movie called The Lady from Cheyenne. Ooh. And I didn't think I was going to put this on my list, but the more I thought about it, and I reread my original review of it, I had to put it on here. I'm not really big on Loretta Young. I find her to be very uptight, and I don't agree with her as a person, but I also didn't really seem to care for her films until I saw this movie. This movie I watched because I was trying to watch a lot of Robert Preston films. I did an article about him, and I wanted to know about his career before he started lampooning it in Blake Edwards movies and before he was the Music Man, and I found out that he actually played like a lot of dashing leading men. The Lady from Cheyenne is not his movie, it's Loretta Young's movie. And Loretta Young plays a woman who goes to a small western town called Lauraville, where she wants to open a schoolhouse. But for reasons, the local mayor burns down her schoolhouse, and she wants to take him to trial. But she understands that he'll never get convicted because there are no women serving on the juries. So what does she do? She wants to get justice by campaigning for women's suffrage. The entire movie is about one woman getting all the women of this town together to campaign for women's suffrage. I was literally sitting there with my mouth agape thinking, this is 1941. How is this movie existing? It is brilliant. I mean, and this movie has so many pointed critiques, not just about men, but about government. The men are all sitting in the trying to vote on whether they can smoke in the meetings. Like, right. That's literally the whole meeting is them trying to decide whether they can smoke. She gets all these women together to change these laws, and they're out for blood. They're like singing a theme song about how they're going to hang this guy from a sour apple tree. I was in love with this. And this is another movie, interestingly enough, it's attributed to a writing team of Warren Duff and Catherine Scola. And it was released actually 8 months before the U.S. entered World War II. And it's very aware of the contributions that women were making. Annie, the Loretta Young character, is this independent woman. She says she's never really been interested in politics, but because as a woman, she's really never realized how limited she is, which, again, I'm just sitting there thinking, oh my God, this is fantastic. And there's a character in this movie, I think he's played by Willie Best. He's the guy who stands out front of the meetings and just opens the door. He's an African-American, in case you don't know who Willie Best is. He's the smartest man in the room. He helps her figure out how to write bills, how to get them passed. And the movie doesn't really know what to do about, like, how her disenfranchisement as a white woman is different than his as a black man. But he's not an idiot. He's actually really smart and knows more about the law than she does. And they work together. And I really enjoyed this movie. It is so fascinating. The only reason I can't think it's available out on DVD yet is because they were like, nope, it's too progressive. Too progressive. It's going to be insane. People are going to freak out. But it is so fantastic.
That is good, because that sounds like the kind of thing that could have aged horribly. Like, that could have really gone wrong.
I was waiting for this movie to be this, like, horrific idea that, oh, women don't need the vote. Like, there was going to be some pandering at the end. There's really not. Like, Robert Preston ends up marrying her, and she doesn't lose anything.
So great.
It's awesome. I wish it was out on DVD for everybody to enjoy.
I wish we could submit our lists of DVD requests to the powers that be and have them just manifest. Okay, Kristen, my next one is kind of a cheat in that it is not a classic film, but I'm included it, and you'll know why, because we had talked about Filmstruck had been bringing films into our lives that were new to us. And part of the gift of what they're doing is not just the films themselves, but a lot of support materials. So they had some great documentaries or featurette, which I think film fans, it's helpful to have that access. And I think we crave it. So the next film I have is a documentary about Lon Chaney. It's called Lon Chaney Behind the Mask.
Ooh, I haven't seen this one.
Oh, it's great. It's from 1995. Lon Chaney, very obviously, is classically, like, he's in the canon as one of the sort of original stars and someone who also looked at performance and looked at it in film, because obviously in stage work, they've been doing things with makeup and character creation for centuries, probably. But in film, it reads a little differently. And the idea of what he brought to this new industry in terms of characters, and characters that were often grotesque or afflicted or tortured, that had a fear factor to them, especially in seeing it in the light of this documentary, of seeing the humanity that he was bringing to the roles he played. And I will just do a caveat of, there's definitely, as is the case with a lot of older films, there are some problematic elements, or, you know, like, there's whitewashing. He played characters of other races. It's definitely a red flag. I do think the artistry and the intent that he approached his work with was transcendent. And it, when you watch all of those together, like obviously his most iconic are things like in The Hunchback of Notre Dame and The Phantom of the Opera. And you think of them, and it's not just because of the silent film element, but there's a physicality to his performance that's so far beyond assuming a hump. I'm grateful looking at how similar to what we were just talking about, like there's a time when a lot of the choices he was making could have gone very wrong and could have felt like parodies. It could have been taking on the idea of affliction or of otherness and making a mockery of it. And I think he makes full characters of, he makes full people of the characters that he's playing. It was such a great doc to see. And it also thankfully then made me revisit some of his films. I definitely watched one of his because of this film, which is such a great thing when you see that, like, I want to go check it out now that I know about this. But the other thing that he brought to mind, and speaking of why it'd be great to have so many of these on DVD and have them available in physical media, is something like 100 of the films that he worked on are lost. They're gone. They're gone forever. Like, we will never see these performances, these creations. And I think people don't realize how much lost cinema affects us culturally and just affects the idea of what we're doing. There's a permanence to film, or a seeming permanence. It's not there. Like, there's just so many that are gone. So anyway, Lon Chaney Behind the Mask was a very cool, I recommend checking it out, especially it sounds like you haven't seen it.
I have not. I know I have one of the documentaries. I think it's Man of a Thousand Faces. I still have to watch that one too. I'm very fascinated by Chaney. Having only seen a couple of his films, I'm really intrigued by his backstory.
Man of a Thousand Faces wasn't a biopic?
There is a biopic.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. The James Cagney one, right?
It's James Cagney and I think Dorothy Malone. It's very Hollywood version of his life. My next one, my two, goes about as far from Lon Chaney as you can get. I'm talking about 1938's Four Daughters. Yeah, you know, you knew I was going to include something. Okay, come on. I've seen Four Daughters probably the most out of all the movies on this list. I actually have the Four Daughters box set. So, I love John Garfield. I created a column on my blog purely so that I could talk about John Garfield movies under the guise of working. And Four Daughters, I think, is probably one of my favorites of his movies because it's so different than most of the stuff he did. This is a pure slice of Americana. You have the Lemp daughters, played by three Lane sisters and I think Gail Page. They are all musicians, musically inclined in different ways. They live with their dad, played by, once again, Claude Rains. They all have different things they want to accomplish in life. One of them wants to marry a rich man. One of them just wants to sing. The other two plan to be cat ladies forever. And, of course, men show up and take them down the primrose path of getting married and being domestic. It's a very stereotypical melodrama for the late 30s, but I love John Garfield in this movie. This is his first film, 25 years old, and he is, A, he's gorgeous, for starters. But he's also the little black rain cloud that comes to salt the entire Lemp household. Priscilla Lane plays Anne, and she's a moron. I'm sorry. I love Priscilla Lane, but she's an idiot in this movie because she's all hung up on this guy named Felix Dietz, who's just milquetoast personified. She's in love with him, but then her sister is in love with him. John Garfield shows up and he falls in love with Anne, and they have this like cute little chemistry together because she's very peppy and blonde and positive, and she tells him something and he's just like, yeah, the world sucks. I didn't get anything for my birthday. My parents died and everything is terrible. And okay, you're a Debbie Downer, but you're adorable, and I love you. So their chemistry is very cute, like this opposites attract type of thing. It ends about how you'd expect, because the movie had sequels and John Garfield wasn't in them. So you should really anticipate who's going to make it out of this movie. It's a really great example of like the homegrown film that just makes you feel good, that we, I think, all love classic films for, this depiction of the homestead as being one where these women are in their, you know, early 20s and they all live with their dad and under one roof and it's totally fine. I find this to be very charming.
Four daughters. It does not surprise me at all that I didn't know which John Garfield it was going to be from you, but him as a wee 25-year-old makes sense.
He always looked older than he was. So even at 25, he looks 35, but it's really good. I mean, he got nominated for an Academy Award for it.
Oh, nice.
So didn't win, but he should have. I actually got for Christmas, I do a classic film Secret Santa gift exchange, and my Santa knows me very well because they got me an actual John Garfield signature, which is sitting on my wall right across from me.
That is someone that gets you.
So Drea, what is your number one?
So these were in no particular order. I'm incapable of listing things. I don't know if you knew that about me, but I do feel good closing on this one. This last one is a 1947 erotic film drama, ooh, Kristen. And that film is Black Narcissus.
Oh!
By Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger.
Yeah, the archers.
Just a little film about jealousy and lust in a convent of nuns in the Himalayas.
As one does.
As one does. This is one that I feel like I've heard referenced for its cinematography, and not just that, the color. It's so vibrant and so even us who are used to watching everything in color, it still kind of takes your breath away. And I can imagine if you were used to black and white and walking into this and having the dual nature of A, all of this color and like natural, like flowers and mountain, like all of these like natural images, nature-based images, and then B, the lustiness of it. It's British, so it's my favorite too, that it's definitely suggestive throughout and definitely has an erotic theme to it. But it is 1947 British erotic, meaning it's not like you're going to go see a skin show. It's a clean, it's maybe not something for a family to watch together unless you like to be uncomfortable. It's also not like, oh, I'm embarrassed if someone walks in as I'm watching. What you may be embarrassed about, and now I kind of am, that I have two films that have some sort of weird whitewashing of white actors playing other ethnicities. So please know, I'm aware of the problem of that and wish they had chosen better. The stories themselves, like this is about this group of nuns who go to this location in the Himalayas. The idea is that they're going to set up a school and a hospital there. And of course, though, because they're so far away from the calming, tranquil embrace of the British Isles, that they start to become unmoored and increasingly drawn into sensuality and, you know, how the world is around them. So Deborah Kerr plays the Mother Superior, and she's trying to forget something that she went through back at home. Then there's a local British agent. So they have someone to pine over. There's a lot going on, and parts of it can feel a little melodramatic, but I think Deborah Kerr is incredible. And I also think that every department matched the level of color. So the production design, the costumes, even the makeup, how they shaped all of it to take full advantage of what they were doing with the color story was really incredible. So I think Black Narcissus is a really interesting film. And then in looking at some reading before we were having this conversation, I hadn't realized it was released just before India achieved independence from Britain. It's kind of woven in the colonialism into this story, and the idea of this film coming out as that was happening in the world and the cultural significance of it is pretty remarkable. And I love when film can mark the passing of torches and the, you know, change of the world in such a artistic way. It's pretty incredible.
I have not seen this movie and I feel very bad. I've had opportunities to see it. I miss them.
Well, if you want to see what it would look like to turn a harem into a convent and a school. This is the film for you.
I have no excuse. I do love Powell and Pressburger did The Red Shoes, yeah, and Matter of Life and Death, yeah, which I love both of those. So I just have not sat down to watch this, and I need to. That's a great one. My number one is one that I've talked about to death. You've probably heard me talk about it somewhere in some form. I'm sure I've talked about it on one of these episodes. It's, again, from my most favorite year of 2018, 1941. Don't ask me why. It's Out of the Fog. I've talked about Out of the Fog a lot. I love Out of the Fog. Oh, it's so good. So Ida Lupino and John Garfield made two movies together, and they're both great. I almost put The Sea Wolf on here, but I did not. I went with Out of the Fog. When we talk about honorable mentions, I might throw out an additional bit of love for The Sea Wolf. But Out of the Fog is the great story of two old men. They want to buy a boat, but they have no money, and so they're just kind of content with their lot in life. And then John Garfield plays this great coat-wearing racketeer, like, blackmailing,
of course he does,
who extorts them for money to quote-unquote protect their boat from being lit on fire by him. And at the same time, just to screw with the one guy, he starts making the moves on the one guy's daughter, played by Ida Lupino. And Ida Lupino is pretty much the unsung hero of this movie, because all she wants in life is just to get out of her small town. She does the same thing every day. She lives on the docks. She goes to work at the telephone company, and she has to date Eddie Albert. Like, that's her lot in life. You know what? I feel for her. Okay, that sounds boring. I'm sorry. And all the people who love Eddie Albert, I'm sorry. Boring. So John Garfield shows up in his sweet coat, and he's like, hey, I'll take you out to dinner. Go out on the town. You can buy whatever you want. And then he's like, I want to take you to Cuba. And she's like, sweet! But everybody tells her no, because John Garfield's evil. But you're never not going to make a wish that there's an alternate ending where poor Stella gets to go to Cuba with John Garfield. I dream of that ending every day. I know some people dream of the Snyder Cut. I dream of the alternate ending that doesn't exist for Out of the Fog, where Ida Lupino and John Garfield get to go out to Cuba and have fun, and it's probably X-rated, and it's amazing.
Your love of rooting for the bad guy, if that bad guy is played by John Garfield, knows no bounds.
I watched this movie for the first time, and he, again, the coats. I am a sucker for a man in, like, a good coat. He comes out in this full-length, like, trench coat with the fedora, and I was just like, dead. It's over. Take me away. I don't know what to do. I love it. I bought this movie as soon as I could. I've watched it several times. I forced my friends to watch it and just been like, just look, you'll get it. You'll get it in 10 seconds. Why he's amazing, and they don't get it. And I keep trying. It's great. Everybody should watch it.
You know, I would be sad if you ever lost your consistent love of the bad guy.
It hasn't happened yet, and it's been this way for several years. Let's just say I'm having a housewarming party. Drea will be at it, and I will try at a certain point to be like, hey, everybody, we should watch a movie. Out of the Fog. We're going to watch it.
Oh, my God.
So, Drea, were there any honorable mentions, things that almost made the list, but you didn't include them that you want to give a shout out to?
Probably yes and no. There were so many. We're lucky to have access. We're now looking at a medium that's been making art for however many years. So there's a lot. No, I don't have any to add. And I feel good about the range that I put in, especially because I snuck in a film from the 90s. I feel my work here is done.
I'm okay with that. I had a couple honorable mentions, things that I wanted to include. So there's the 1941 Deanna Durbin film, It Started with Eve, that almost made this list. It's very cute. A couple Ida Lupino movies I almost put, The Drive by Night with Humphrey Bogart and High Sierra, that are really great. You should go watch those. The Sea Wolf is the reason I love John Garfield. Blame that movie wholeheartedly. I did want to include the Betty Davis, Miriam Hopkins film, The Old Maid from 1939. I thought it was Old Acquaintance, and then I realized it was not the same movie. And it was actually really good, about a woman who has sex with a man and then has a baby, and really the fact that she's had this child out of wedlock isn't really a problem. You know, the rest of the movie, they just kind of like ignore it. I thought was really great. And 1948's A Date with Judy with Jane Powell and a 16-year-old, I think she's 16, she might be 15, Elizabeth Taylor playing Carol Pringle, the frenemy to poor Jane Powell. It's a movie that is incredibly problematic with the fact that like Robert Stack plays a 30-year-old soda jerk and he's into 15-year-old Elizabeth Taylor, or the fact that Elizabeth freaking Taylor is how I described her, is supposed to be the best friend to Jane Powell, and Jane Powell thinks that like she has a shot when it comes to men. I'm sorry, I love Jane Powell, but when your competition is Elizabeth freaking Taylor.
Yeah, I would not want to be up against Elizabeth Taylor at any age. And I can only imagine the just like crazy, her 16-year-old and violet eyes, forget it. Forget it.
And of course, Postman Always Rings Twice. I had never seen the original.
Oh, nice.
I finally watched it because it's got John Garfield in it. And that movie is saucy.
Yeah, saucy is a good word for it.
And then you like read the trivia about how like him and Lana Turner were probably sleeping together the entire time they filmed it. And it's got like the first open mouth kiss ever recorded. And you're just like, God, I love this man. Stop it. It's been a very interesting year watching John Garfield movies. So that's actually going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can let us know your thoughts on what movies you discovered in 2018 that you love. You can email them to us at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and we'll read them on the next episode. Drea, where can fans find and get in touch with you?
I am on Twitter, at the Drea Clark.
Well, you can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of different ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, Stitcher Radio, or whatever app you get podcasts, or on iTunes. And if you're listening via iTunes, please consider helping us out by leaving a rating and review. And visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. And the podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. And if you want to learn more about upcoming episodes or hear exclusive content before anyone else, then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. We have a ton of amazing perks, and all your donations go straight back into the show. If you become a patron right now, you can listen to our two new supplementary shows. Co-host William Bibbiani and I look at how Hollywood talks about itself in cinema with the show Based on a True Podcast. Our latest episode, we looked at the Jennifer Love Hewitt starring Audrey Hepburn story. Woo. Yeah, Jennifer Love Hewitt played Audrey Hepburn, and it was very interesting.
It happened.
It did happen. You can also hear Adam Kautzer and I talk about the dual versions of Lolita soon. We're going to be doing that on Doubled Features, where we look at the films Hollywood makes again and again. You can also check out past interviews I've done, and it's patreon.com/ticklishbiz. And if you want to learn more about the stars turning 100 this year, I'm keeping TCM's exclusive article series Centennial Celebration. If you're a member of TCM Backlot, you can read my year-long series about the stars who are turning 100 in 2019. We're not going to talk about them this year on the show, but I did an article about Carol Landis, which is on TCM Backlot right now, so you can give that a read. Drea and I are going to close out, and we will be back next time. What are we doing next week? We're talking about Catherine Grayson, correct?
Oh yeah, we're going to have some Kiss Me Kate.
Yes, so we're going to be honoring Catherine Grayson, TCM's Star of the Month for January. We're going to hope to get this episode out very quickly because we were talking about 1953's Kiss Me, Kate. Drea has not seen it. I have seen it several times, and I have many a fun story about the first time I saw it. Well, that'll be next episode, so we'll talk to you then.